Hello and welcome back to the Andrew Haynes Show. Today's episode, we sat down with Tommy George, the president and managing partner of the Sports Advisory Group. Tommy is an extremely passionate ice hockey official, and he even officiated the 2014 Winter Olympic Games in Sochi, Russia. Beyond that, he and his team at the Sports Advisory Group are leading the field in sports mergers and acquisitions, specializing in minor league sports. We hope you enjoy. Support for the Andrew Haynes Show is brought to you by Manscaped, who is best in men's below-the-waist grooming. Manscaped offers precision-engineered tools for your family jewels. They obsess over their technology developments to provide you the best tools for your grooming experience. Get 20% off and free shipping with the code AGH at manscaped.com. That's 20% off with free shipping at manscaped.com using the code AGH. Your balls will thank you.
Back for another show, and today, I always say this every time, they're going to be fun, because they are always fun, I think, especially this, because I consider myself a serial entrepreneur. I've bought and sold dozens and dozens of businesses over my career. You know, I'm like the guy who flips the houses. I flip businesses. And so we've got a great guest today. He helps people buy and sell businesses, and more specifically, sports teams. So what's even better than that? So I've got Tommy George with me. He's from the Sports Advisory Group. How's it going, Tommy?
Good. How are you?
Good, good, man. Thanks for joining me.
Absolutely.
I know we've talked over the years, and I always see your company out there, you know, putting together some deals for most of these minor league teams that get sold. Yep. So walk us through, like, your background. How'd you even get, you know, involved, you know, in that?
Yeah, no, it was kind of, by sheer coincidence a little bit. I had worked in the nonprofit world for many years as I pursued a career in ice hockey officiating, thus the jerseys behind me. And then once the NHL, kind of told me that they weren't going to hire me or pursue me as one of their, on ice officials, I realized that it was time to, pursue a career that was more of a career and something that was going to produce long term, as opposed to being in the nonprofit world, which, unfortunately, for most jobs in the nonprofit world, it's nonprofit for the corporation and then also for the employees. So it was a long process of looking for the right career, the right position, and, you know, trying to use my background. I was a sports management major. I went to Western New England College, which is in Springfield, Mass. And I was really looking for the right opportunity in sports. And I wasn't looking to work for a team, and I wasn't looking to necessarily, go into sales or you know, something of that nature, or wasn't looking necessarily for marketing or something else. And I met Larry Grimes, and Larry Grimes is the former owner and founder, chairman of Sports Advisory Group. And we talked about his company and a position that he had available with his company. And as I got to learn more about the company and what they do, I thought that was very interesting to me, and a very interesting opportunity and a very interesting niche within the market as well. And Larry took a chance on me, I like to say, and offered me a position with the company. And that was 5 years ago now. And we had a lot of success. And then I acquired the company from Larry in 2019. And he's still with us as a chairman, founder, advisor, all the above, whatever he likes to, whatever role he likes to assume on any particular day. But he's great. So we have another associate, Bill Yates. He lives in Fort Worth, Texas, and we have another associate in Jesse Grant, who's in Fairfield, Connecticut. So we're all regionally based. I'm in Frederick, Maryland, and Larry, just out of sheer coincidence, is about 20 minutes down the road from me in Gaithersburg. So I got in not knowing a heck of a lot about mergers and acquisitions, not knowing a lot about sports ownership, other than maybe just, you know, the average sports fan or the avid sports business fan. And Larry had kind of taken me under his wing and really given me a lot of advice and tutelage along the way to be able to help make me successful, and help make our company successful. So that's how I got in. It's not a real Not a real.
Was it a big transition? I mean, was it a big learning curve for you? I mean, because that's a lot of information that's probably different than you're used to.
It was. It wasn't necessarily a big learning curve as much of it as it was learning the word patience before I was a parent. It's really a patient industry where nothing happens in a day or a week or a month or even a year in some cases. So you have to have patience, and that's one of the things that we talked about a lot. But then also really just understanding, you know, deal structure and what buyers look for, what sellers look for, what leagues look for, what makes a successful ownership group, what makes an ownership group unsuccessful at times. And so it's a lot of learning as you go. I still like to learn every day, and I still like to do whatever I can to get better on a daily basis. And I don't know everything about the industry still, self-admittedly. But I like to surround myself with the people who know more than me, and that helps everybody. So that's kind of the goal.
I mean, it's a constant. I mean, you know, everyone, you got to continue to learn and evolve and shit. I mean, things change just, you know, in the last 10, 20 years, just with how teams operate and
the last 10 months too. So
it's constantly evolving. So what's a tip? Is there like a time in your head that you say, okay, well, a team will typically sell in 6 months?
Yeah, that's a good question. I've told people that we have worked with potential buyers and they have found the right opportunity and the right team and the right fit for them very quickly and closed on a deal in as soon as a couple of months. For other people, we worked with a couple clients where it's taken them 2, 3, 4 years to find the right ownership opportunity that kind of meets their criteria. So that is that's where the patience piece of it comes in a lot. But yeah, like I said, nothing happens in a day, nothing happens in a week, and nothing happens in a month. So I always tell people that, you know, the typical transactional cycle is, you know, minimum 6 months, just because there's, you know, when you buy a team, there's a due diligence period, there's a process of putting together legal documents, there's a process of getting approved by a league. That's probably at minimum 90 days in most circumstances there, not to mention, you know, meetings and negotiations and things that take place along the way. And that's just with somebody once they have found that opportunity. At the same time, if the team or the seller has a maybe less than attractive opportunity for most, you know, not something that's the most profitable team or something the most attractive market, that can take longer. And that's also, again, where that exercise and patience comes in for buyers and sellers.
You got anybody?
it becomes tough there. Yeah.
Well, you're dealing with, you know, interesting people. I mean, I've been a league president before, so I know how some of these owners, you know, the egos and the background, they're so broad and all over the place. It's a lot of different personality types to be working with to put a deal together.
It is. So it's interesting to kind of see how they all are different and then are all the same. But you're right. It's a whole smorgasbord of personalities and characters. That's for sure. So
what's the process? Let's just say I own a team, you know, and I want to sell. Like,
sure.
You know, how's the whole process work?
Yeah. So, our company would come in and really be able to give you some background thoughts first on the team and the opportunity. Our company primarily focuses, we'll back up a little bit, on minor professional sports. And people might ask, well, why do you focus on minor professional sports and not, you know, major professional sports or the Big Four or something like that? And I say, we'd love to do those deals, and we have done and been a part of deals like that in the past. At the same time, those valuations are exponentially higher. than, you know, a minor league baseball team or a minor league hockey team. And so that immediately disqualifies about 99.999% of people who want to own a sports team because they're not billionaires. And so minor professional sports, the valuations are lower. They also span and have a broader geographical net. Minor league baseball, for example, as of today, you know, spans from the Pacific Northwest, Florida to Maine, and anywhere and everywhere in between that too. So if you wanted to buy a minor league baseball team, you could say that really just about anywhere in the country meets your geography. But if you wanted to buy an NFL team, you're already limited to 32 cities. And, you know, if you're going to say, well, I'm going to buy the next NFL team that comes to the market, well, that's great. If you live in LA though, and that team is in, you know, Nashville, let's say, that may not meet your geographical needs. Whereas in minor league baseball or minor league sports as a whole, there's more opportunities that are, you know, more geographic centric to something that you might be focused in. And because those valuations are lower too, there's a broader net of potential owners that exists. And so we found our niche in being able to work with those buyers and sellers and pair the right person with the right opportunity. So going back to your question, how that started for us, we then come in and we'll really give an ownership group an honest opinion of their team and their operations. And because we have experience working across every single league and level and sport and deal size, we have been very successful in being able to have a broad understanding of what those deals look like and what buyers are going to say, and then what challenges that sellers have had in the past too. Excuse me. So we come in and give a real strong, solid analysis and thought to a potential seller. And hey, this is what you can expect. These are questions that you're going to get from buyers. These are strengths. These are weaknesses. And here's kind of our honest opinion on, you know, what we think you can expect from potential buyers. And that also includes evaluation. It includes timing. It includes the questions that someone is going to get during a due diligence process of, you know, why did you do this? Or what about the sales process? Or, you know, what does this mean on your P&L statement? What are these expenses type of things? Because we've seen so many deals, we'll be able to see things that kind of stick out immediately and provide that feedback to a seller. And then as we move forward, you know, our network and database is so broad and so vast that we probably already have talked to or come across someone with interest in that team in most circumstances, not all circumstances, but most. And then being able to marry the two and pair up the two in hopes of the buyer and seller then pushing and negotiating towards a deal that makes sense for both parties. So it sounds a lot simpler than it is at times, but that's theoretically what we do then. And then we assist both buyer and seller, whoever we're working with in that particular deal, in due diligence and structuring the deal in a favorable manner for whoever our client may be. And then, you know, working all the way through past closing so that the transitional piece of it too has been completed and satisfactory to everyone involved.
So it sounds like you really kind of dive in there to get a good understanding of the business. You're not just, hey, send me these papers and, you know, we'll get it.
Yeah.
I mean, you really are understanding, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly, hopefully,
yeah,
to help,
yeah,
you know, communicate.
Yeah. We'll dive into everything from concessions agreements to lease agreements to, you know, looking at how a team's marketing plans work and, you know, how they do in sponsorship and, you know, what does their staff look like? Well, you know, how many people are employed? You know, what would a buyer say about having six persons at this particular position in marketing and whatever it may be, so that we can help provide that feedback. And again, that feedback is really what can help a seller be realistic in their expectations too. You know, every seller that we've ever come across thinks that their team is worth you know, this or that or whatever it is, and they think that they're the greatest team ever.
You bring them back to reality.
Yeah, but it's also just because, you know, you don't want them to be able to you don't want them getting unrealistic expectations, yeah, because that ultimately won't lead to a potential transaction. And, you know, ultimately our goal is to assist in negotiating that transaction. So
And I take it the seller is the one who compensates you, not the buyer, right?
We either work for buyer or seller.
Okay.
So if you came to us and you had a team and you wanted to sell your team, our company would be compensated by you and work alongside you in the process. If you came to our company and said, you know, my goal has always been to own whatever team, I need your help in reviewing documentation and due diligence and helping me structure the deal for my favor, then we would work alongside you in that regard. So our company has had so much success on both sides of the field that most teams and minor league owners know that if our company is calling, that we either have somebody who is well qualified and well educated too in sports ownership, that they're going to take our call and field our call. And then at the same time, you know, if we're working for a seller and we bring somebody forward who we think would be a good fit, they also know at the same time that we've done that work to make sure that that person is educated and well qualified as well. So
have you ever sold the same team more than once? Like, just, you know, like, you know how cycles, I mean, sometimes an owner gets in, they're in for a few years.
Yeah, we had one team I can think of that we've that happened with, and it was more or less just because the I'm trying to remember the gentleman who sold it the first time, he had bought it, and then he was there for 3 or 4 years, and then his wife got a new job, and this was smaller summer collegiate baseball team, and had to relocate and wasn't able to you know, really make it accessible for him to get there, and so he went back to our company to find him a new owner, and we did, and so that was one example in particular. Another example I could think of is we had sold the Class A baseball team in Fort Myers, Florida.
A miracle. Now the
yeah. So we had assisted in the transaction from the Gold Clan Group to Jason Hochberg, and then Jason Hochberg, at the time he was living in the East Coast, and then he ended up moving with his family back out to San Diego, and Jason had come back to us and said, you know, if you find somebody who's really interested, I'd be a willing seller at this point, just because for myself getting from San Diego back to the East Coast, it's just not the easiest thing for me anymore. And I still love the team. I still love the market and everything about it. But the travel is just not allowing me to put the time and energy and effort into it that it deserves.
Hear-
so that's when we had found Andy Kaufman, who is now the owner of the now Mighty Muscles, who bought the team and is doing an awesome, awesome job there. So,
yeah, no, it looks like they're doing, I lived down there for a few years and, love the rebranding. You know, they've got the hockey team now too in Jacksonville. So building a nice little
Andy's a great client. He's a great owner. You know, he is somebody on the hockey side that he didn't know a lot about minor league hockey when he got into it. And we had assisted him in that transaction too with the Icemen. And he had called me and said, you know, I went with my kids over to the Iceman hockey game, and he goes, now I got to buy this team because it's right here in my backyard. My kids loved it. They had a great time. And it's funny because hockey, I'm a hockey guy, obviously, but hockey's a different animal. And Andy was totally gung-ho about baseball and everything. And then he got into hockey and he was like, this is equally as fun, if not more fun. I think part of it is because it's in his backyard, but he started to understand. Yeah, and so that was part of it. And from that perspective, you know, most hockey owners tend to be hockey people, which is great. I'm a hockey person, but they tend to focus more on hockey and not revenue. Whereas Andy was totally been in his whole career and his whole background focused on revenue. And then you bring that in with somebody who already has sports ownership experience, and it's really turned that team and it really turned that team from being a great team to a really, really exceptionally well-run organization that's one of the top in that league now. And I know that there's other owners within that league who are now looking to that as the model, and this is how we should operate moving forward, is being more focused on revenue.
What kind of feedback do you get after you sell, like from somebody like that? They're like they were just shocked, or like something like, you know, they weren't expecting, like, you know, because I can tell you this, I've owned sports teams and I've owned regular businesses, and there is quite a difference in operations and just, you know, everything, marketing, you know, it's totally different. And I know being a league president, I used to get a lot what you just said. People come in and they focus on the sport instead of the business. Yep. And they make a lot of decisions that they wouldn't make for their normal business. And, you know, they don't want to spend here or there. But has anything like stuck out as like a big thing that, you know, a lot of people just are kind of, you know, woken up to?
I don't know. I think what you're saying though, and I think this is true, and maybe this answers your question, is that a lot of people make decisions with the heart, a lot of times necessarily in sports, and not, you know, maybe not necessarily from the business perspective, as you said. And I think that's a great analogy, that there's a lot of people who would come in and they do things, you know, that if you took out the sports aspect of it and you strategically just looked at a P&L statement and financial documents and things, that if it was a manufacturing company or something else or a retail store, that you would say, well, this doesn't make sense. Why are we doing it? And then you come into sports, and one of the answers, one of the things that we hear a lot is, well, that's the way it's always been done, you know, and that is a recipe for disaster, in my opinion, in a lot of cases, because you know, the way it's always been done, well, that's great. You know, look at the last 10 months, for example. The way things have been done for the last 100 and some odd years are going to be very irrelevant moving forward after the last 10 months in a lot of different areas and a lot of different aspects of a sports business and traditional business as well. So that may be one of the things that we've seen a lot that kind of sends off a red flag of, well, it's always been this way, or that person's always made X dollars, or whatever the case may be. So
how has COVID affected you and the sale of teams?
Yeah, so that's an interesting question. So our company's been fortunate enough where we have kind of maintained our normal level of business today, which is great, because there's lots of people out there obviously who've been affected in a negative manner, and you know, that's very unfortunate, and I'm sorry for those people. We've, like I said, been successful and really maintained our status quo. Now that being said, I believe, and a lot of people believe, that in the next 6 to 36 months, you're really going to start to see the after effects of this. And what I mean by that is, you know, right now, when this all started, sports owners, they came into COVID and they said, well, we applied for this government loan money and we got 6 months of it, so we'll make it through. Well, it's been 9 months now, and a lot of those monies are starting to dry up. And, you know, with an election coming soon, who knows how that future may look. Would there be more monies? Will it be less monies? Will, you know, how will that work? You don't know. But what you're really going to start to see now is, we've been through one baseball season that's been completely wiped out. We've been through the end or the conclusion of a hockey season last year that was completely wiped out. And so you're really going to start to see exponentially impacted ownership groups on a financial level moving forward. Some of those groups are going to have the financial capabilities to make it through, but some will not. And that's where you're going to see a lot of transactions and a lot of transitions from one ownership group saying, we can no longer sustain this business model. We can no longer do this. Is it best for us to sell it? And maybe somebody with deep pockets can come in and take over because we can no longer afford to do it. Or are we just going to simply fold the team? Because I think that's a significant risk here moving forward. And so I foresee a lot of transactions coming, like I said, in the next 6 to 36 months, the majority of which would be impacted or affected or caused via COVID and its financial ramifications. And again, I use that window because, you know, we have no idea what next baseball season is going to look like. You'll have some states, I think, that would play at 50 or 75 or, you know, heck, maybe even full capacity. I also think that you'll find some states even next summer that are still at, you know, 5, 10, 15, 25% capacity, you know, and that may not even be till July 4th, you know, who knows? So that unknown piece of it really then affects an ownership group for next year. How much revenue can we generate? How much ticket sales can we do? How many, you know, what do our concessions look like moving forward? Not only on the revenue side, but on the expense side too. How many of these groups and municipalities and cities are going to require that there are more stringent cleaning measures? Is there, you know, more social distancing at a ballpark, which eliminates certain areas? So there could be increased expenses too to go along with a decreased revenue scenario that's really going to have an impact. So, you know, again, I think, you know, an ownership group may look at this after next year and say, we were okay off the start from COVID, but here we are 18 months later, and we're just going to be in that same position. So that's where I think you're going to see a lot of impact and change. And I think you'll see, at least in my shoes, a lot more sports ownership transactions than you would see in the traditional marketplace. So yeah.
In a world where people are more aware and plugged in than ever, it's not enough to just have a great product. Consumers are looking for brands they can relate to. That's where Egghead Creative comes in. Everything they do is powered by deepening the connection with your brand. And every time you do business with them, they'll build a bespoke team of highly specialized creatives designed specifically around what you need. For more information, visit eggheadcreativestudio.com. That's eggheadcreativestudio.com. Or follow them on Instagram at eggheadcreativestudio. Now back to the show.
Do you think that will drive pricing down? Or do you think that they're going to be able to maintain valuations and, you know, through that?
I think you're going to see, you know, traditionally valuations have gone up. I think you're going to see a level of stagnancy for the next couple of years, at least in that window. I think over a 10-year period, you know, the COVID blip is going to look like, if you look at your, you know, your 401k or your stock portfolio, you know, over a long period, it's shaped, you know, like a diagonal, you're fine. But then when you really zoom in on certain windows there, you'll see levels where it's very stagnant. So I think valuations over the long term will continue to grow up, and that's not the issue. But over the course of the next 6 to 36 months, you're going to see those valuations be very flat. And the other thing with that too is that that's going to impact not only teams that have been negatively impacted by COVID, but if I just owned a team and I was, you know, it was time for me to sell because I'm 83 years old or whatever it is, that's going to impact that person too, because they may not get the value that has been expected for them moving forward, just because the marketplace, you know, currently just doesn't support that valuation. So it has an impact on everyone, no matter how the team is performing or how the team is doing. So
how do you think minor league baseball will be impacted from, you know, the valuation standpoint with everything going on with MLB and MILB? You know, I know there's going to be some contractions. I was working up in Virginia with the Fredericksburg Nationals for most of this year. How do you think that will play out from the sales side?
Yeah, so minor league baseball has been the great question mark here in all this. And people who've contacted us and said, hey, we want to buy a minor league baseball team in the last 9 months, because they think if there's, you know, COVID implications, I then have to tell them that, you know, nothing is going to happen right now in the world of minor league baseball until this professional baseball agreement or whatever it's termed as moving forward is agreed to. And then I have to go in and explain to everybody what this agreement is and why contraction is happening and how it's going to impact the future, and that it really has nothing to do with COVID, and we would probably be in this scenario. I don't think the timing would be the same, but we would be in a similar scenario in terms of contraction moving forward, whether we had a pandemic or not. So the pandemic just pours kind of gasoline on the fire in the world of minor league baseball for some of these ownership groups that don't have the resources or the financial capabilities to be able to improve their facility to save them from contraction, or a municipality that no longer has the monies that they, you know, need to improve their facility to meet the requirements of Major League Baseball or whatever it is. So that piece of it in the minor league baseball world has been interesting. At the same time, you know, the new agreement, when it happens, I think, at least from what I've heard and what I've been told, is going to have a positive impact on the teams that do survive for a couple different reasons. One, just a natural supply and demand economics. There's going to be a fewer supply, and the demand will still be there. I think that part of it is without question. So that's the first piece. The second piece is this agreement moving forward, at least the terms that have been thrown out there by Baseball America or discussed publicly or rumored publicly, are really going to give strength and stability to those 120 teams that make it through, because they're going to have long-term agreements with their affiliate. They're going to have the ability to have increased revenues, decreased expenses, and a geographical territory for that league that makes more sense for travel. So that's expenses. But then also for fans to be able to have more regional rivalries and different things, and also more of a regional tie with who that affiliate is. You know, the example I always give there is I'm a Nationals fan, and the Nats AAA team was in Fresno, California for the last couple of years. Makes zero sense. Yeah, so, you know, their AA team is in Harrisburg, single A team in Northern Virginia. Yeah, Fredericksburg, Potomac. The other single A team out in Hagerstown, you know, and then their AAA team was 2,700 miles away. It just didn't make sense geographically. So how can you fix that? And then how can you alter that so that all the teams have their affiliates in a regional location that makes sense? Maybe doesn't even have to be, you know, close to the major league affiliate, as if it's, you know, clustered or close to the other minor league affiliates as well, because that's the big piece there. So that part of it, with the combination of everything else, again, long term, the valuations are gonna go up. You know, short term, I think you're gonna see the same instability here, or the same level of kind of stagnancy for the next couple of years. Especially because too, there's gonna be ownership groups that look at this and say, man, like, I don't want anything to do with this anymore. This has been a real struggle for the last 20 months. You know, is our team going to survive? Was it going to be contracted? You know, you'll find some ownership groups that may just are tired from that have combined with COVID, that they've said, you know, hey, I think we need to, I think we just need to exit. You may also find some buyers, you know, the other side of this is the buyer side, who are going to look at teams and say, you know, I don't want to own a minor league baseball team anymore because there's been this instability. And you know, what if this happens again? Or, you know, all the same questions that, that could come up. And so I think, again, I think short term, you're going to see, you know, a relatively flat level of valuations. But long term, you know, once this gets ironed out and we're back to normal or whatever that is, I really do think it's going to have an increased effect on valuations and make the partnership stronger and make the team stronger and make minor league baseball stronger as a whole too. I think that's a bigger piece of this is that it you're going to certainly have communities that are impacted negatively by losing their affiliated team. I don't question that. I don't doubt that. And I feel for those communities. But at the same time, I think the product as a whole moving forward, in my opinion, would have a stronger place within its ties to Major League Baseball and in the quote-unquote affiliated world of being connected there. So I think that's important. I think the other piece, too, is that you're going to see a growth in independent professional baseball over the next six months to six years you've never seen before. You're going to see the Frontier League and the Atlantic League are going to be the two big benefactors, in my opinion, because they are in geographic footprints of these teams that are going to be contracted or rumored to be contracted. And they'll be able to add those teams to their leagues and do so in a manner that makes sense, but then also increases the spotlight that's on that league. You know, I think of the Frontier League in particular, their league, because they merged with the Can-Am League a couple of years ago, their footprint went from Western Pennsylvania to Missouri. And when they merged, their footprint now goes from Missouri to Quebec. Well, pardon me, but by doing that, they have effectively increased their footprint now where that they could bring on teams to their league in that entire footprint. So they would have the ability to, you know, potentially add 6, 8, 10 teams to their league, which increases the visibility and the attractiveness of their league and obviously decreases costs across the league as a whole too. So that helps everybody. Same thing with the Atlantic League. I think the Atlantic League is in a great position to add member clubs. And I know that they have markets in the East that fit their footprint that would be great fits for that league. And I think independent baseball has gotten a bad rap in the last, you know, 5, 10 years, because people, even on TV, like when you watch the World Series or the League Championship Series last week, they still say, oh, well, this guy, you know, he had to go pitch an indie ball for the last couple of years. Well, that's kind of a negative slap on indie ball. But I look at it as saying, you know, independent baseball is going to become a place where Major League Baseball actually utilizes that to help those players who need to get back to major leagues. And I think, you know, like the Atlantic League, creating that the partner league with Major League Baseball to be able to do that, it's really going to have a great impact on independent baseball as well. And so I think independent baseball is in a great position to, like I said, increase its visibility to help their product, which is a great product. I think the other thing people don't realize too is that the level of play can be very strong. And if you and I went to a game and you took the logos off the chests and the hats of players, and you substituted an Atlantic League team for some other team out there at, you know, single A, double A, whatever level you think it would be. You know, you and I sitting there having a couple beers watching the game would have no idea that those players are not affiliated contracted players because the level of baseball is actually, you know, very, very good. You know, the negative connotation of independent baseball to me has always been short-sighted. And I think, you know, the next few months and years for independent baseball is really going to shine a great light on that product in those leagues. And so, I think they're in a great spot, and hopefully they'll be able to work it out with those cities that, you know, have the unfortunate pleasure of being contracted, and there's ways that those teams can continue and merge into those other leagues successfully. And I hope it works. You know, however they decide that it's going to pan out, I hope it works, because again, you know, 95% of the people, as you know, Andrew, from going to games, they don't know what the score is at the end of the game. They don't necessarily know that, you know, this team is affiliated or this team's not affiliated. The true baseball people and the true sports people will understand and will, you know, kind of say what they have to say. But if you have the right front office and the right sales staff and the right marketing people, the right staff in place for you, you know, that part of it, you'll be able to whiz right on through this and continue moving forward. And, you know, we'll be all the better just for it. So
I know we're running out of time. So I had two other quick things I wanted to get.
Sure.
If you can go through like the different levels and like kind of like price ranges, if you can, just to give people an idea, like a, you know, ECHL hockey teams, you know, typically sell between $1 million and $5 million or things like that, to give kind of perspective with minor league baseball, independent, and the hockey. And then how do you come up with the valuation? Because when I typically buy a business, I look at evaluations differently for a regular business than I do, you know, a sports team. And a lot of times people coming in have to look at that a little bit differently as well, as where that value comes in.
Sure. So I can't comment too much on the valuations in some of those leagues. I would tell you that your window there is pretty accurate for the ECHL. You know, for affiliated baseball, Forbes has, you know, published a list, you know, in recent years of different team valuations. You know, I always tell people that a single A team is probably somewhere in the $10 million range. You know, a double A team is probably in the $15 million range, and a triple A team is in the $20 million range. And when I say that, you know, that also doesn't, that's not the ceiling by any means whatsoever at any particular league or team. You know, the Dayton Dragons, which was a single A team, they sold for $40 million or whatever it was back in 2014. And Forbes has valued certain teams at well over $40 or $50 million. And I would say that that's still the case now, that there's teams in affiliated baseball that have had valuations of, you know, well over $20 or $30 or $40 million that are justifiable. And then you go back to your other question of, well, how is that justifiable? And sports transactions as a whole and sports valuations as a whole are comp based. So if you think about like the way that major league sports are valued, it's very similar, just on a much smaller scale. You know, when C. Ballmer bought the Clippers a couple of years ago for $2 billion or whatever it was, and everybody said, what are you doing? There was a little bit of strategy in that, because what he did then was he took the value of every single NBA membership and raised it exponentially. You know, guys who were part owners of some of the lower teams within basketball there, whoever you want to classify those teams are, they were the biggest benefactors of that, because their floor of what their value, they thought their team was, just went up maybe by double. So very similar in minor professional sports as well. It's very comp based. And so if you looked at it and tried to apply a traditional business metric, like you would when evaluating a manufacturing company or retail company or some other business, and you'd look at that and you'd say, well, it's X times revenue or X times earnings or EBITDA. That's traditionally been a way of valuing a business or industry. Whereas in professional sports, it's much more comp based. And so you comp it out similar as you would to real estate. You know, this team, like this house is 4,200 square feet and on a half acre lot and in this neighborhood. And you know that if you took that same house and took it to a different side of town or a different city in a different neighborhood, the value could change and could change significantly. Very similar within minor professional sports as major professional sports too. You know, think about like the New York Rangers. the New York Rangers, I think, are the highest valued NHL team. And I think their valuation, Forbes had them at well over $1 billion or maybe close to $2 billion. But then the lowest NBA valuation now is right at the same level of you know, the highest NHL valuation. And so how does that work? Well, same thing. You could take the greatest house in the greatest city in the greatest market and put it into a different market. And, you know, like my house in Maryland, if you put it on the cliffs of Malibu, it would be, you know, 20 times worth what it is now. You know, so that's the perfect example. And that applies across every single league and level, whether it's minor league hockey or major junior hockey or independent baseball, summer collegiate baseball, the G League, any of those leagues where we have done work. You know, I tell you that it's a completely comp-based industry. And for most buyers, part of my educational process is being able to tell them that, hey, you're going to have to get your arms around the fact that this is a comp-based industry in terms of valuations. And it's also an asset appreciation industry where it's going to appreciate over time. And that's where the true monies are made. Even if you struggle year to year, you know, very similar to those major professional sports, over time, you're going to continue to have increased valuations based on comp transactions and the fact that supply and demand and everything else that helps to raise those valuations for those ownership groups. And that's what you see. And again, the same principles apply for major professional sports as they do to minor professional sports, but it's just on a much smaller scale and obviously without those giant TV contracts and some of those other big time sponsorships and things too. But
how can people see what you have and how can they sign up? Because I get your newsletter, which I think is great. Yep. So how can people get on that and find information about you?
Yep. If you go to our website, which is thesportsadvisorygroup.com, there's a tab on the right side. If you go down, you can sign up for our biweekly newsletter, which has lots of information on industry trends and sports transactions and things that are very relatable to sports transactions and valuations, whether it's stadium news or revenue or different pieces of that help to contribute with or relate to sports ownership. But then we also include projects that we're working on and be able to share information a little bit on that. So if you're interested in acquiring a baseball team or a hockey team or whatever it is, it's a great way to stay in tune and be able to connect with our company and learn more. So,
well, Tommy, thanks for joining me. It was great chatting and good luck over the next year.
Yeah. Thanks very much. Thanks for having us and all the best to you and wish you well.
Hey, podcast fans, thanks for listening to today's episode of The Andrew Haynes Show. If you enjoyed it, be sure to leave us a review on Apple Podcasts. If you have any questions, be sure to reach out to Andrew on LinkedIn. We'll see you next time.